Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Hello, and welcome to episode 240 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
You wrote recently about something you found in the woods, a shed whitetail antler half buried in the ground, its lines chewed down by rodents. What remained was still impressive, a reminder of a powerful animal that likely isn't alive anymore. It's a simple moment, but it points to something we don't spend much time thinking about. Every living thing has its moment, strong, vital, alive, and then it's gone. You write that unlike other animals, we're aware of that. We know our lives are limited, and somehow that awareness creates the possibility for something deeper, a kind of attentiveness to the life that goes beyond just getting through the day. You've described that as reverence. It's the ability to recognize both how rich our meaningful life is and how brief it is at the same time. And yet it seems that's not how many of us live. What matters to us should matter, but we often live as if everything is urgent and lasting, when in reality, very little is. That shift in perspective can at times be grounding. So, Rick, let's start here. If life is this brief and fragile, and if that awareness is what gives rise to reverence, why do you think we don't live that way more often, and what gets in the way?
Two things get in the way. Distractions, which, you know, like various forms of amusements and entertainments and little things that keep us busy and keep our mind moving from one thing to another.
I'm sorry, I was looking at my phone. Could you say that again?
No, I'm just... Exactly, Scott. That's it. That's what keeps us from living in a more meaningful way. And then the other thing is just self-deception, where we try to trick ourselves into thinking that the things that we invest in are more permanent than they actually are.
This topic was, or this word, reverence, was the topic of a public lecture you and your colleague Tom Thibodeau gave just last night at Viterbo University, and I had the opportunity to attend. And I don't know if it was you or Tom that said this, but, and I think it's true, is that we don't use the word reverence all that often, but the word irreverence sometimes comes up quite a bit. Why do you think that is?
We've become really a radically secular culture. I think there's been, in some ways, a reaction against a kind of religious earnestness that we take it as being maybe foolish or misplaced or something like that. And reverence is so religion isn't the only place where we have the experience of reverence, but it's one of them. And we have kind of, it's easy to celebrate irreverence, especially on media where there's comedy, for example, like laughing inappropriately, that sort of thing. And also earnestness in general is easy to poke fun at, right? And so we become a culture that is really adept at. And sometimes that deserves being poked fun at, but there's also there are moments in our life where we need to be solemn, right? And I think that's where reverence comes into play. And I've never tracked the difference in the word, but yeah. You hear irreverent being mm-hmm. used all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And I think somebody asked a similar question to this last night, and I'll ask it to you in a slightly different way, but as you talked about this last night, and as we'll talk about it today, there are other things that sort of overlap a little bit. I think the two that come to mind for me are respect and gratitude. And those are two things that are also important. But it sounds like you would put reverence as sort of a deeper, more maybe religious meaning. And maybe the difference, I suppose, is that it rises to the level of becoming a virtue. Is that right? And maybe you can talk a little bit more about how those differ and why being labeled a virtue is like different.
Well, I think reverence is often kind of the underlying feeling that supports our behaviors of indicating respect and gratitude, of saying thank you to somebody, of treating somebody with kindness or politeness, addressing them appropriately, that sort of thing. But underlying that is this idea of reverence. That is, that the person that we are encountering has inherent value. They have this great dignity, and that by treating them badly, I'm not appreciating their inherent dignity. And so, like, reverence absolutely underlies these behaviors of things like respect and gratitude.
And you mentioned, of course, how we treat people, and that's important. But we started off, when I did the introduction here, about something you wrote, and we'll share a link to it in the, so folks can read more about it. But you came across this antler shed in last weekend out in kind of a very quiet part of the countryside, and you showed reverence for that. And obviously that's not a person, so reverence can extend quite beyond just how we interact with each other.
The feeling of reverence, I think, is evoked any time that we find ourselves in the presence of something that is quite deep and quite meaningful, and at the same time recognize, in contrast, the temporality, the fleetingness of our own lives, and somehow like the inconsequential nature of many of our everyday concerns and preoccupations. And so here I took a walk in the woods, and I was walking around looking for antler sheds. And these are...
Oh, so you were looking for them, actually.
I was looking for them, yeah. It's just an occasion to get out in the woods this time of year. There's not a lot going on. It's not a hunting season. It's also not like morel mushrooms haven't started to pop up. I love to hunt for morels.
And even in Wisconsin right now, there's not a lot of green shoots right at this moment.
Yeah, and this is a great time to look for antler sheds because deer drop them usually sometime between December and March. But you can't really hunt for them in the snow if they've been buried by snow. So once the snow melts, but before green things start growing and covering them up, that's a good time. You can walk through the woods without, you know, fighting a lot of brush. And so I was just, you know, walking around, and I noticed something unusual. It didn't look like a typical shed. It was just like a little, like, bit of white stick poking up that was unusually kind of bright and odd-shaped. And I bent down to look closer and found out it was the end of a deer tine from an antler that had been mostly buried in the ground, and then it was this mostly covered with pine needles, and it had been chewed off, so it was just a stub. And so I pulled it out, and it was the remains of a huge antler, but all the tines had been chewed down by, you know, like squirrels and porcupines. There's all kinds of rodents that chew on them for minerals. I pulled it up, and I picked it up, and I was reflecting on the kind of animal that would have produced it, which would have been probably the biggest deer I'd ever seen. I've never seen an antler with a main beam that size, and thinking like that antler wasn't from this season. It was because it was partly buried, and it would have been probably from a year ago, which would make that deer like way beyond the average age of like the, you know, white-tailed mortality. So I'm reflecting that it's probably not alive anymore. This is all that remains of it. And then reflecting on like, this is what happens to all of us. At some point we become food for worms, as like that was the old saying in medieval times. This is our common fate. And it just like, kind of in a flash, it made me reflect on the fleetingness of our achievements. You know, here was an animal that was like proud and strong and graceful, like probably the largest deer in the woods, and this is what's left.
You mentioned it makes us how fleeting our achievements are. You said, and I'm sure that's true. When I was thinking of this topic initially, I was also thinking, and maybe this is, you can tell me if this is the wrong direction, but I was also thinking how are the fleetingness of our failures, that there's so many things all of us do in our lives that, you know, if we had things, had a chance to do it over again, we'd do it differently. And these usually aren't like life-altering decisions, although maybe occasionally they are. But there's certainly things that we have minor regrets about. And like, that's fine. But I think, you know, and sometimes like that can like be a sort of ruin your day, something you did wrong. And you're like, you kind of stew on it a while. And I think personally, it's important to remember that, yeah, this thing that's not fun today will seem a lot less bad tomorrow. And like a week from now, it won't even be top of mind. And a month from now, you'll have forgotten it. And a year from now, if somebody brings it up, you might not even know what they're talking about. But then we talk a lot about living in the moment. But also, can you live in the moment and also try to like put that moment in a larger perspective?
Yeah. So like when we say live in the moment, what we mean is like appreciate the significance of the moment. And
that's usually a good moment, right?
That's usually a good moment, right. But it implies this idea of putting it in perspective, like what really matters, and don't get caught up in worrying about a bunch of things that may never happen and forget to appreciate the good things that are happening right now. But that, I think it goes along with exactly what you were saying, is like, don't get caught up in how bad whatever mistake you made or like,
or something problems, somebody did to you that was bad.
Yeah. Don't get caught up in worrying about like the lasting effects of these. That's transitory as well. And put all of that into some kind of greater perspective and recognize that like, as human beings, like we're really pretty remarkable creatures. We do have an awareness, an access to those things which are greater than us, and we can tap into them. Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher of the 18th century, said there are two things that invoke ever increasing awe and wonder: the starry heavens above us and the moral law within us. Like we are in touch with things that are quite profound. We should not forget that. That's a key idea of reverence. Like there's profundity all around us.
During the conversation last night, and I think it's true, is that in general, people practice reverence and seem to be less reverent today than they were generations ago. And my theory on that maybe goes back to just what you said, is if you were living in this world 500 years ago, there was a whole lot about the world you didn't understand. And even like if like really smart people understood like why the sun rose and set the way it did, I mean, that information was not always disseminated. And like the world was full of wonder. And you might have come up with like stories explaining things to how the natural world existed. And maybe you believe some of that, and maybe you just realize some of those were stories. But, you know, many generations later, like today, we've not answered every question, but we've answered a lot of those questions. And that a lot of that wonder maybe has ceased to be. And do you think that is in some ways because we at least think we have the ability to control our outcomes more than we used to, that reverence sort of gets pushed aside because this world of wonder is actually just kind of can be explained away in science and we can maybe try to manipulate it in some small and medium-sized ways?
So I think this is part of the self-deception that I mentioned before. Like we think we've explained away a lot of the mystery or the wonder of the world. I don't think that's true, because the most profound causes of wonder have to do with the meaning of our existence that is attached to questions about why. And we haven't answered any of those. Like science answers how and how questions. Like, and it's in that sense, it's relatively narrow in its scope. And when we think we've answered why questions, like what is the point of our lives, by answering like how do species evolve, like we're missing the point there. I think the reason reverence has declined is mainly because our lives have sped up so much. And when we look at simpler cultures and also the history of Western culture, earlier times, what we find out is that in a slower paced lifestyle, what happens is that rituals become much more important as ways of transmitting what's culturally important and keeping people's focus on what is, like, what do we really want to pass along to the next generation? What do we want to keep alive in our shared or common life? We are a culture now. In most Western societies, we have cultures that have largely dispensed with ritual. And when you dispense with ritual, you also dispense with reverence.
And when I think of someone who's reverent, and I think of someone who, I mean, they're not robotic in a way that they're just like unemotional. I don't think that's true at all. But they don't seem to have those really high highs and really low lows. They have that ability to sort of regulate their emotional extremes a bit. Is that a way where we can kind of convince people that being reverent is good? That, like, you can say to them, taking this virtue and practicing it will make your life kind of sand off the rough edges. Is that it does? Because I think there are some people who really like the world you describe in a way that is fast paced and constantly moving, and rituals get pushed aside. And I mean, not to make you the salesperson for reverence, but if you were, it sounds like your pitch would be that there's just a little more peace in one's life when you practice that, because you're not always looking for the next hot take, or you're not always trying to jump at the next trend.
Let me illustrate with a story.
Sure.
This is one of my remembrances of reverence, and like an early example of it in my childhood. I was at the Turkey Day Parade, the annual Turkey Day Parade in my hometown.
Once again, Boise, Minnesota makes an appearance.
Yeah, and you know, and there's a bunch of us, and there were some family members that had come into town. One of them was my uncle, who I really admired. I only got to see him maybe, you know, two or three times a year, but he was one of these guys who had all the new toys. So he had, you know, he had motorcycles and snowmobiles, and he had this really cool boat. And when he'd come in the summer, we'd get to go water skiing. And he was a really busy, active person and a lot of fun. And I'm sitting on the curb next to him, and the parade comes by, and everybody starts standing up. So I stand up too, and there's a marching band coming down with the flag, and they've got the American flag and the state flag in the front of the marching band. And he reaches over and grabs my hat and takes it off my head. I was kind of embarrassed, because I look around and see like all the men have taken off their hats, and it hadn't occurred to me. And he was just reminding me, this is something you do. So here was this person that I really admired. He was really fun to be around. But there were moments of this life where he put his interests aside. There's a public reverence. And that would occur, like when the flag appears, you stand and you take off your hat. You interrupt whatever you're interested in, and you pay attention to that. And I would say this was not a person who I would say would be a model of reverence. And yet he would interrupt his life at these moments, and they were shared public moments. And I thought, like, that made a deep impression on me. Like, why is that? Like, of all the people, like, he's the person that I would have listened to most about something like that, right? Because I admired him so much. I wanted to be like Uncle Jack. And so I think that you're right, that reverence can take off these rough edges. But it also centers our life in a way. Like, he was somebody who was always in pursuit of thrills and adventure. Like, that's the kind of person he was. And yet he was also, in a way, he was grounded by the community in a certain way, by these certain touch points.
And I'm glad you brought up that story. And I think there are some people, though, that might hear that story and say that, I'm sure there's somebody who's done like a research project on this, like, why is taking off your cap when the U.S. flag comes by like a thing? Is that a thing in other countries? I don't know. It may be, it may not be, but it is like an interesting thing. I mean, you know, I don't mean to be glib about it, but I mean, someone could have decided, like, lo, those many decades ago, that like standing on one leg is like what you do when the flag comes by.
So that's a really good point.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that happens in our society right now is we tend to be too superficial about things like this. Like, we tend to ask, well, yeah, like, it's just a meaningless gesture.
Yeah, someone decided this.
Somebody decided it at some point. And you're exactly right that, like, why taking off your cap becomes important. That's a historical accident. The thing is, but there is something that we all do that is a public demonstration of us showing that we are attending to something important in common. Now, it could be a whole bunch of different things. That doesn't really matter. You're exactly right about that. But that we do something to take our attention off our own selfish interests and put it on to something that's public, that we agree is important. That's significant. And that's what reverence is.
And I'll just tell a funny baseball story it occurred to me. And I cannot remember the manager, but in a baseball game a number of years ago, at the bottom of the seventh inning, or the top of the seventh inning, there was a controversial play on the bases. And the manager comes running out to argue with the umpire about this. And he's yelling about this and may have been ejected by this point. I don't know. But whoever decides such things, they decided they weren't going to wait, and they were going to start the singing "God Bless America" at the seventh inning stretch. So somebody comes out and starts singing that, and the second that starts up, the angry manager pulls off his cap, you know, puts it over his heart, stands there, looks at the flag, song's over, puts his cap back on, and starts yelling at the umpire again.
Right. That's beautiful.
Yeah,
I love
that. Yeah, but I think, and like, okay, so we'll stick on flag and patriotism for a moment longer. I'll admit this is probably going to make me sound like a bad person, so this won't be the first time on the show. But I think it is great, and I first of all, I think, not to get too deep into politics, but I think, unfortunately, at this moment in our country, if you fly a American flag outside of your house, sometimes that makes people believe you're maybe more Republican than Democrat. And I think that's bad. I think we should all be proud of the flag. I think especially in this year, which is the 250th anniversary of our country's founding, patriotism is a good thing. You can like the president. You can dislike the president. I don't think that has anything to do with whether you should fly a flag.
Let me say this about that attitude. And yeah. I've talked to a number of Democrats who, like, in different organizations, don't think we should say the Pledge of Allegiance at a meeting of the organization because it shows partisan.
Or it says under, like, God is a phrase somewhere.
Yeah. I like, are you telling me that we have a political party that wants to run the country but doesn't want to express pride in living here?
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't make any sense. And I think that it's a deep contradiction that I think that has plagued Democrats.
I agree with all that. I agree with all that. And I also think, and I think there are times where I'll be walking down the street, whether it's a business, whether it's a private home, somebody has taken the time to put a American flag out on their house or on their place of business. But I will admit that sometimes I'm like, why did you do that? Because your flag is like tattered and torn and it needs to be replaced. And I think that's also not a great sign. Is it, you know, it should look good and it should look. But then this is where I start sounding like a bad person. I do find it odd. So like, if you're one of those people who like flies the American flag and you're like, gosh, you know, it's time for a new flag. It's getting a little tattered around the edges. I'm going to put a new flag up because I'm proud of my country and I want it to look good. And so you buy your new flag and you put it up and you take your old flag down And then you're supposed to like dispose of it in this like weird way. And like there's like boxes, I think the American Legion or other places have this. I think some the ones I've seen are sometimes like repurposed mailboxes.
Yeah, but you don't throw it in the trash. That is that's
like,
the key
and like
thing.
That. And that to me, that's where it seems weird to me. Like, I think it's great to show others like this public thing. But like that part, I guess to me,
okay, so
seems weird.
So there's always when you talk about certain behaviors that are really important, there's usually a gray area where you can shade it into like, well, what about this detail or what about that detail? Surely that's not that important.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like saying, you know, like there's actually no difference between day and night because there's these times of like dusk where it's really hard to tell. Well, which is it? Is it day or is it night? And isn't it just a arbitrary convention that we say it's not sunset at 7:21, but it is sunset at 7:22.
And tomorrow it'll be different.
Like, yeah, and it'll be different. Like, and surely it's somewhere in between. And yeah, there's certain acts that we do that display reverence. There's certain acts that we can exhibit irreverence, and there's kind of a borderline in between. But in some way, it's just convention that we've decided. Okay. Like if we're going to show respect to the flag, one thing you don't do is you don't throw it in the trash
with your coffee grounds.
Yeah, we also always display it in daytime.
That's true. Yeah,
or with the light shining on.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, like and so it bothers me. There's somebody in our neighborhood who has a flag that just is on a pole and it stays up all the time with no light on it and you know and they never take it down.
But I mean
that shows me a kind of disregard or an ignorance of the conventions of reverence,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's not intentional. I know it's not an act of irreverence. It's not intentional, right? But it also shows that we're living in a society now where, like, people don't think these things really matter. And I would like to live in a culture in which we do think that certain kinds of behavior do matter because it displays a shared attitude towards what is important and what is trivial.
I want to pursue that just one step further. There's a wonderful podcast out there called Away with Words, and it is hosted by Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, and they talk about all things in the English language and you know, from etymology of words to regional dialects to interesting phrases. And it's a good show if you're into that sort of thing. I'd recommend giving a listen. One of their overwhelming things they talk about is that the language is ever evolving. And somebody will, like, for example, and I'm sure you've come across this in your everyday life. If you go to, and this happened to me the other day, I was at a local sandwich shop and you know, I pay my bill and you wait 2 or 3 minutes while they prepare your sandwich. And they're like, you know, here you go. Here's your ham and cheese. And I say, thank you. And the young person behind the counter says, no problem. And that's like, and I know there's certain people that just bothers to no end because it should be you're welcome. And it's like, you know, what, no problem seems like I was inferring there was a problem and what have you. And this, and like things like this is a discussion that comes up on Away with Words. And their position is, about many things, is that the language constantly evolves and that the intent is more important than what the words you're used to. And they're in, like, you know, the old expression, ain't a word. Well, that they would say that's absolutely not true. Of course it's a word. It's a word people use all the time. You know, and there's been studies that show, for example, that people with Southern accents are unfortunately presumed to be less intelligent than people who don't have a Southern accent. And that's just not right. And there's, you know, certain words people use because of where they were raised. We should have, with an ever evolving language. And if you went back to the 1700s and tried to hang out with people in this country, you would stick out a lot because the way you speak is very different. So I use all that. And language is really important. I mean, if you were listening to a podcast, of course it's important. So, like, why can language evolve? And I think you would agree that that's okay. But some of these traditions, like taking your ball cap off at a when the flag comes by, or disposing of your tattered American flag that hung on your house for 5 years in a way that we've done for generations, those things should not evolve.
Well, I think they do evolve, and they should.
But, like, who decides then? Like, who decides that one day it's okay to fly your flag at night?
Well, like, who decides about language? Like, we kind of decided in common, and what happens is, like, the common practices change. Like, what's regrettable about language, and it's really evolving very quickly, is when, for example, we get, like, generations that are unable to communicate with one another because language is changing so fast and it's becoming so filled with slang among very young people who are really conversant on social media and new forms of social media that they cannot communicate effectively with older generations. And then you develop all kinds of misunderstandings. And that's unfortunate. And it's especially unfortunate, say, when you have younger generations who don't think it's important to learn certain conventions of communication, which allows them both to understand and be understood by older generations. And I think the same thing goes on with our ritual practices. The ritual practices have to necessarily change more slowly than language does. And we as a society should be more intentional about it. But they absolutely do change. And so even in places that are very intentional about rituals, like churches, for example, we'll often have discussions about, like, how do they change certain, like, certain ceremonies. So, like,
well, and churches are very different. I mean, you can go to one church in your community and another, and you'll have very different rituals and very different experiences.
Yeah, and we've even find things like both funeral and wedding ceremonies have changed a lot in recent years, and like have different rituals associated with them, which is fine. I'm all for it. I don't think we should be doing the very same ceremonies that were done in the 16th century. But I think it's important to have some rituals, mm-hmm. right? And for us to observe them kind of seriously. And in the same way, I think it's important to have certain standards of communication, some agreement on, like, how do we convey meaning to one another? That's why I like a program with Away with Words, is because they actually do take that quite seriously. And they want to look into word history. How did words evolve? What meaning and how are they being used now? But they also recognize that there are times when real problems come up because people are using words in quite inconsistent ways, and then you get miscommunication.
Before we close on this segment, I wanted to bring up something that Tom, your colleague, mentioned last night at the public lecture at Viterbo University. And he said, and I think it's right, is that the opposite of reverence is arrogance. He sort of said the foundations of reverence are wisdom and courage and temperance, and arrogance, of course, can make all of those things a whole lot worse. And arrogance is not a new behavior. It's certainly been around as long as people have been around. But do you get the sense that because we're living in a more individualistic society, that arrogance seeps in more often than ever before?
Yeah, and arrogance is really a product of narcissism, thinking more about yourself and thinking yourself as more important than anybody else, and then ignoring other people's legitimate interests and concerns, And Tom Thibodeau had quoted Paul Woodruff saying that reverence is a sister virtue to justice. And so justice and reverence go together. And where you don't have reverence, you can't have justice. In other words, where you don't have reverence, you can't have right relationship among people. Because what happens is arrogance precludes being in right relationship because all of a sudden I'm not properly attending to your concerns and your needs. I'm just focused on myself. I think that's right, that as we become a more individualistic society, arrogance becomes a greater problem. And we see it in the diminishment of reverence in the public, right? Like fewer ceremonies, fewer rituals, harder to agree on what we all think is important.
And looking for ways to get attention, and getting ways to get attention is not just doing the same thing we've always done.
Right. And I mean, and in a way, you know, like there's all this emphasis now on how do we get individual intention? How do we market ourselves and get ourselves out there? All this stuff.
What's your brand?
Yep. But also in the society where everybody else, being more narcissistic, cares less and less, right, about what we as an individual are saying. And so it's a counterproductive pursuit. It's self-defeating. And yet we don't really recognize that that's what's going on.
With the American Express Platinum Card, I can unlock experiences like no other. Since I'm always booking my next trip, I love that I can earn points on travel. Plus, I get a Resi benefit, so you know I'm hitting the restaurants everyone's talking about. And you can find out your welcome offer after you apply, which could be as high as 175,000 points. For experiences like no other, there's nothing like platinum. Learn more at americanexpress.com/explore-platinum. Terms apply.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Scott, what is your question for me?
Rick, a couple of weeks ago, I thought I had lost my wallet at the gym. I went back to look for it, but it turns out, thankfully, it was at home the whole time. Still, it made me realize how dependent we can be on strangers doing the right thing. So, Rick, here's my question. If you're at a gym on a day that is unstaffed and you find a wallet in an empty locker, what is your responsibility? With no one to turn to, how far do you have to go to make sure it gets back to the owner? Or do you just simply leave it there and assume the person who lost it will quickly return and pick it up?
Yeah, that's really interesting, because if you, like, I think you have quite a bit of responsibility there. But as you say, it's unstaffed. You can't just turn it into the front desk.
Exactly. I want to be clear. This happened. I was at this gym on a Sunday. This particular gym is not staffed on Sundays. And so I was thinking to myself, if I did, in fact, leave my wallet at this gym, I think most people would be like, oh, here it is. I'll give it to the staff member. And they would try to contact me or put it in a safe place, because I'm sure that must happen somewhat regularly. And that's what made me think, what would I do on an unstaffed day if I came across this, you know? And like, I thought to myself, again, putting myself in that position of losing the wallet, like I came back like probably 2 hours later, you know, if somebody had taken it and like put it somewhere, well, maybe I would have just assumed they would have left it alone, because I knew what locker I had used. It's not a super busy gym, and it's a Sunday, which maybe was a quieter day. I don't know. So I just wasn't, that just raised all sorts of questions.
So it was like, was sitting on a bench in front of the locker or on
the
floor?
Well, I mean, I didn't know. My assumption was I could have left it like on the shelf inside like these lockers that you use during your visit to the gym, or maybe it had like fallen on the floor. I had left it in the couch cushion at home, but yeah, I went back there thinking it could have been any number of places.
I think in a case like that, I would have said, okay, so here's the couple questions.
Sure.
One is, you should do what you would want others to do in your place. And I think like if I had been the person who lost a wallet and somebody found it, I would want them to not to just leave it there,
mm-hmm.
but to try some way to get it back to me. To look in it, look at, like, see if they could.
There's an ID.
ID, track me down, try to contact me. Or I think, if not that, do something like leave a note at the place. I've got your wallet. Here's my phone number. And I think, like, you would know that if you took it, you could find the person or leave some evidence so they could get in contact with you, but you would be able to get it back to them. Whereas if you're just leaving it, you have no idea
what's going to happen.
And you don't really know if the person's going to come back and look for it, because they might not know where they misplaced it.
They may have been 10 places. In my case, I had been one place, the gym.
Right.
But I may have been 10 places that day.
Yeah. Yeah, they could be like quite sure they lost it at one of a couple different places and forgot about the like the possibility of the gem.
So what I asked Travis this question, and what he would have done is he said he would have gone and, you know, there's like this front desk area, two chairs and computers, like, you know, kind of like you'd picture. Mm-hmm. And he said he would have taken it and like tucked it like under, like on a chair that was pushed in or somewhere, and then left a note to the, you know, or, you know, left a note for the gym kind of tucked away somewhere, maybe through a email saying, hey, I found this wallet. I put it on a kind of hidden away on this chair, which again, that probably keeps it safe, but it doesn't, like, for me coming back 2 hours later, I'm not going to rummage through the front desk to try to find my wallet, right?
So, right.
I mean, it doesn't get it back to me right away. And then another friend who I was talking to this about during the two-hour window said, oh, you should go check your mailbox. I'm like, what? Yeah, maybe somebody found it, saw your address, and put it in your mailbox. But then I thought to myself, I remember there were times, especially when I was younger, where the address on my driver's license didn't always match the address where I lived, as I was renting and moving around more often. So it just got me thinking that there's so many things that people might do that are like well-intentioned, but you just don't know necessarily what the right thing to do is. And, you know, obviously we don't live in an era now where most people are in a phone book. So if I find Rick Kite's wallet, are you in the phone book? I don't even know.
I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, who knows where the phone, but
like there's ways of finding people online sometimes, but usually you don't anymore. You don't find their phone number, right?
Exactly. Or maybe somebody's, you know, maybe their name's, you know, Steve Johnson, and there's a lot of Steve Johnsons, right? So it's just tricky. And I just think even, you know, obviously the answer is not rifle through the wallet and take what you want, but it is like, what's the best way to go about returning this? And I guess so. I'll ask this question. So let's say you decide to like open it up and see if there's an ID in there or something. Would it change what you would do if you just noticed there's like hundreds of dollars of cash in there?
Yeah, I think so. If there's ID, there's like credit cards, a lot of cash, things like that, makes it more, I think, more urgent. Mm-hmm. and more significant.
And the person's probably more panicked, I would think.
Yeah. If it's an old wallet and all they've got is their gym membership card or something, and that's all they brought, you know, and maybe, you know, then I'd be more likely to say, drop it off, lay it on the desk and maybe with a note in the gym saying, hey, your wallet's, if you lost your wallet here, it's at the desk, something like that.
Yeah.
If I have a lot of cash, a lot of credit cards, something like that, I would say that it's more urgent because, again, putting yourself in that person's position, you would think, I would want somebody to really treat this carefully and go out of their way. I would hope somebody would take it upon themselves to go out of their way to get it back to me. And so I think you should do that.
So I want to extend this one step further. So let's say you're at the gym during the unstaffed hours. You find this wallet. You take a look inside, and there's like probably a couple hundred bucks in cash. There's a few credit cards. There's all this, you know, a lot of stuff in there. And so you do just what you said. You're going to try to reunite this with the person who lost the wallet. And, you know, let's say you do a quick internet search or something, and you like this person has a unusual enough name that you come across the person, you're able to like at the gym try calling the person, they answer, you're saying, hey, are you a member of XYZ gym? Yes. Well, I think I found your wallet here. They're like, oh my gosh, they're very thankful. And you learn that you don't live ridiculously far apart in the community, and you say, hey, I'm heading home now. I see you live on 12th Street, I'd be happy to swing by and drop it off. I'm sure that's something you would do, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So you do that. And so you find their house and you walk up to the front and you knock on the door. You know, you even maybe looked at the person's ID. This is definitely the person. Everything looks normal. They're very grateful. And then they say to you, gosh, I really appreciate you doing all this. This was, you know, went above and beyond. Here's $50. What do you say?
I don't know. That would be a judgment call in the moment. Certainly not necessary and not even expected.
And this, again, this was maybe took you 5 minutes out of your way.
Yeah. Yeah, probably say no, like that's not.
No, I insist, sir. I insist.
Sometimes people want to give a real expression of their gratitude, and it makes them feel better to do that. And so, in that case, I mean, I'm happy to say, like, thank you. That's really appreciated. But that would have to be like a judgment, like how important is this to them that they show their appreciation in this way. It certainly wouldn't be something that I would expect, and even like
it's not why you're doing it.
Not why you're doing it. No, I tell you what. Like your story brought up a memory of a few years ago. I found a stray dog that was wandering in our neighborhood, and as soon as I the dog spotted me, he comes over and wanted me to pet him. It's a real friendly dog, pretty big. It was a black lab. But I thought, like, he looks really thirsty, like he's and hungry. He's obviously looking for somebody. So I brought him home with me. I had been out on a walk, brought him home, gave him some water and a little bit of food, and he was just really hungry. And he had a tag with a phone number on it, and that's all that was on the tag. It was just one of those metal tags with the phone. So I called the phone number, and somebody answered, but it wasn't the owner of the dog. It was the person that I called had been somebody that had given the dog to somebody else.
Oh, boy.
And so they ended up contacting that person with my phone number and getting, but it was a matter of like 3 hours, like to get a hold of this first person, to get a hold of the second person. And meanwhile, I had the dog at my house in my yard, and, and meant I had to like stay home for a couple hours. I had to cancel a couple meetings, but I thought it was worth it, like, to get that dog returned. And then the person shows up and didn't seem very appreciative. Oh, this dog's always running away from me. Like, okay, so I'd like really interrupted my day, yeah, you know, to do this. And but I'm still really glad I did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
you didn't get $50. You didn't get an appreciation, but you knew it was the right thing to do.
This is the right thing to do. And, you know, it's a couple years later, I'm still really pleased. Like, in some ways, it's a good memory. I have no idea, like, what meetings I had to cancel and so forth. Yeah. Like who knows what that was. All I remember about that day, you know, a couple years ago is, yeah, I, like, helped out the dog, and I got the dog returned to its owner. And you feel good about, like, being useful to somebody. And so, like, you should... Like, here's something that the Stoics say. You take, like, anything that happens and you think, like, what is the way in which you think that the universe is giving you an opportunity to be useful? And so instead of thinking of it as a burden, think of yourself, well, great. I have another opportunity to be useful here. And so what can I do?
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcast. That would be useful. And also, check out Rick's column about ethics, which will touch on many of the topics we talked about today. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.
From taco night in Tulum to sushi in Tokyo, make every bite rewarding with gold from Amex. Wherever you dine, 4x membership rewards points at restaurants worldwide are piling up. Learn more at americanexpress.com/explore-gold. Terms and points cap apply.